I'm alone during my afternoon break. Alone, but walking around the building, so not lonely, which I found as a condition aggravated by stasis. Something that can be easily shaken off through striding. Normally I would do this circumambulation with someone else, a colleague who is rather terrifyingly 20 years my junior, but they're away on holiday for a couple of weeks. Sometimes when walking together we are joined by the van driver, 12 years older than me I believe, but they're sunning somewhere too. I'm pausing, measuring distance, my hand resting on the outer wall so I can remain always at arm's length from the building. Why? So I can say I was if I need to. I've been told, indirectly through all staff missives, this break isn't required by law, since it occurs well before the 6-hour threshold set in law. It's more of a gift, a perk really, something to be grateful for, though I don't know where such a feeling should be directed. Boss? Company? Western civilization? Clearly not the universe in this case. So I normally thank myself in the mirror above the sinks in the toilet, my reflection obviously provided by the company. But like all corporate gifts, there are conditions. We're constantly reminded, again through emails, but accompanied by in-person group meetings with our line manager, that ideally we would not leave the building at all. But if we must, then we're not to stray too far, and only within pre-approved areas, usually marked by a lone 4-seater bench, a small cluster of them. This signposting is our manager's own designation, jabbered out under gentle questioning. In summer, I must admit, these seats are great for simulating picnics and friendship, though at this time of year they're unusable, swollen with water, accelerated into decay. Hopefully to survive long enough for a fresh spring coat of amber wood treatment from the facilities team. It's supposedly for emergency, the policy that is, which does make sense, though it also feels like there could be countless other interchangeable explanations to back up the rule, certainly to my cynical mind. I mean, in the case of a fire, for example, we would have to evacuate, wouldn't we? I believe that is indeed the policy here, but for a leaking roof or a burst pipe, they say, for the policies of private companies and institutions are one of those things usefully labelled as an amorphous they. Such water-based emergencies would benefit from a quickly assembled, temporary human conveyor belt, carrying books away from the sloshing and dripping as quickly as passing allows. And as an explanation, this is sufficiently subsidized by reason, even eminently sensible, maybe even inarguable. But as I hinted, it doesn't feel like that in light of the general malaise, which I think is informed by a fuzzy unease. Rather like how we have to ring in within a designated window of time when we are sick. Many a morning I've dragged my feverish frame from bed out to the middle of the green triangle of grass beside our semi-detached, also designated by the phone provider this time as the optimal place for getting a reception, shivering in the open so as to croak down the handset in order to gain permission to feel like death at home. to permit an accompanying payment for my affliction and not be marked as AWOL. I tried emailing last time and was reported by my supervisor for swerving recklessly into the chaos of variation. Illness must be run by management. There must be some say, some control, for the sake of stability, no doubt.
Get your hands off my sickness, you bastards.
The shout brings my inner wanderings back outside the building again. Looking around to find out whether the outburst was inside or outside of me, I see Benjamin Broadcleft, our chief integration and attitudes officer, tottering over from the HR barracks. Internally, I refer to him as Newsreel Dad, due to the jittering and flighty nature of his movements. He looks like one of those sped-up people from newsreels of the 1930s, when film stock was in short supply, and they had to shoot at half the usual frames per second, only attempting to slow himself back down to natural speed by burdening himself with bulky dad wear. You know, jackets, shirts, trousers, shoes and socks, etc. However, this completely fails to backfill the motion detail lost in the temporal translation, and rather has the effect of shrouding the officer in a blizzard of dust and scratches as he flitters towards me, flapping some kind of card in his hand.
Lucy Lingard's gonna sniff when she reads what you wrote, and not in a good way. In a very, very ambivalent way,
he says, shaking his fist and scrunching up his mouth.
Don't you think after 30 years she deserves more than this from you?
He holds the card up to my face, drumming a finger under my message. A trio of haiku, adapted from Basho's early works on the themes of autumn, summer and spring, rendered in their original kanji with a miniature brush and ink, and translated underneath in a cursive, calligraphic hand, all set within an ornate border of intertwining vines, incorporating celebratory chiming bells and cherubs blowing trumpets.
I rather think you best rest at home for a few days and only come back when you have something meaningful to say about Lucy Lingard.
He fumed, tearing the card into ribbons.
Now look what you made me do. I'll have to ask everyone to write out their messages again. They'll be fuming at you,
he spluttered, face turning purple.
And when you set your thoughts on Lucy this time, try to let them stew in the permissive juices of gratitude before dolloping them on to the folio.